Again, good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome once again to emforum.org. I'm Amy Sebring. I'm going to serve as your moderator today. We are very glad you could join us, and for our newcomers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us, and we do count on your participation. Our topic today takes its title from an article we spotted in Emergency Management Magazine earlier this summer, in which the author urges multidisciplinary collaboration to set an action agenda to make our communities more resilient in the face of disasters. He also cited a set of recommendations that we will be hearing about today. And please note that the links to the recommendations as well as other related materials may be found on today's background page, and we will also include them in our transcript. Now, for the benefit of our first-timers, we will begin with an overview presentation and then proceed to your questions and comments. Now, if you have any difficulty with live meeting, you can click on the feedback drop-down menu at the top right and change your color to indicate that you're having a problem. And then my associates, Ava Jean Moore and Lori Weber, will try to assist you via private messaging. We will provide further instructions just before we get to the Q&A, but we do ask you not to submit your question or comments until we get to that part of the program. We also ask you not to send any private messages to the speaker or moderator, as we will have our hands full. We are making a live meeting recording, which should be available later this afternoon, and we are also making audio-only MP3 versions of our programs for your convenience, which you can access directly from our website or by subscribing at the iTunes store. And then the text transcript will be posted early next week. Now, if you do not happen to be on our mailing list, you can just go to our home page and subscribe, and then you will get a notice when those materials are ready. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce today's guest. We are pleased to have the author of the article, Mr. Robert C. Weibel, with us today. Mr. Weibel is principal of Robert Weibel and Associates and is currently the project manager of the Alliance for Building Regulatory Reform in the Digital Age at FIATEC, also known as the FIATEC Streamlining Project. Now, this alliance is a public-private partnership comprised of 40 national associations and government agencies to assist state and local governments in enhancing economic competitiveness, disaster resiliency, and public safety by promoting more effective and efficient administration and enforcement of building codes and standards. Again, please refer to today's background page for a link to the Streamlining Project and further biographical information about our guest. Welcome, Robert. Thank you very much for joining us today, and I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate having the opportunity to spend this hour with you sharing some thoughts and maybe discussing as well some recommended actions on this very critical issue. I'm going to be drawing from 34 years of experience working for state and local governments and also working with the FIATEC Streamlining Project. And FIATEC is a consortium of concerned companies at the University of Texas. If you go to the next screen. The recommendations from the a conference which was held by McGraw-Hill and Engineering News Record and the National Building Museum on March 2nd through 3rd here in Washington, D.C. Indeed, some of you may have attended that function, also will be included in this presentation. Let me cover quickly in the next screen what I'm going to go over in the next 15, 20 minutes with you. We're really going to take a look at what are some of the wake-up calls. If we go to the next screen. So we need to go back one. And what are the problems that we face? Sustaining disaster resiliency and sustainability and the link between those and why those are important to us, and I'll also be covering some examples of some things that are being done right now that do link sustainability with disaster resiliency. Then we'll cover the recommendations from the March meeting and some recommendations that have come from some of the work that we're doing on the outside, and also then get into some actions that perhaps we can take together moving this forward, and then into question and answer and discussion. The first thing really is this past year, the year we're in, 2011, has been among the highest in terms of disasters, both here in the United States and overseas. All of us are familiar with the Christchurch, New Zealand disaster. Indeed, there are sections of Christchurch that will never be rebuilt upon because of that. And Japan's triple disaster of a quake, tsunami, and nuclear events that took thousands of lives and will take more than 10 years to recover from. And indeed, many companies in Japan, just as they did after the quake down in Kyoto and Osaka, have moved overseas to countries that do not have as many disasters. Here in the United States, the man-made and natural disasters, we're seeing a record number of tornadoes that we had this year, the floods in the mid-Atlantic, New England, the fires that we've had in Texas and New Mexico have truly stretched us, not only in terms of economic recovery issues, but in terms of, as we're all familiar with, the funding levels that Congress has just been battling over to try and help these areas rebuild. And indeed, one of the questions we have is, those of you who have read the book on the Black Swan by Nicholas Taleb, are we really prepared for the next Black Swan event? While we've had these disasters, we're still not beginning to try and deal with this in any kind of a holistic way. And here's the problem. We continue to look at the national and local level on the issue of sustainability, economic development, and disaster resiliency as totally separate and unrelated issues. It's forcing us to have those of us in the emergency management community, those of us in the economic development community, those of us in the public safety community, fighting each other in many cases for scarcer resources and public attention in terms of the importance of this issue. As we prepare for, respond to, and recover from future catastrophic events, we still deal with it in both a piecemeal fashion, despite considerable progress at the federal and state and local level in terms of both FEMA efforts and Department of Homeland Security. And yet, less than half of our nation is still covered by building codes that have disaster provisions, mitigation provisions in them for the risks in those communities. Indeed, as we discovered here in the Washington, D.C. area where I'm located right now, who thought we would have a seismic event that we'd have to now start considering in our building codes. And despite our administration declaring that resilience is a national priority, our federal agencies are still treating it in a siloed approach, ignoring links with the issue of sustainability and economic recovery and public safety, and really not dialoguing as effectively as they should with the private sector, state, and local governments. And, of course, as I mentioned before, Congress's attention is elsewhere, focused on budget fights and the coming presidential campaign in 2012. So what is the need for a holistic approach? What I said in the original article is sustainability equals disaster resiliency and resiliency equals sustainability. We talk about a few examples. We've been working over the years to try and help state and local governments streamline their building regulatory process, and by that we do not mean regulatory abandonment. We mean making it more effective and efficient. The simple application of information technology is what this chart shows. This is a standard process. The one on the bottom, the bar chart across the bottom, blue represents the amount of time it takes a permit application to be processed inside a jurisdiction for a large commercial structure. The red represents the amount of time it then takes for the plan review and submission for that building to be conducted. And then inspections are the yellow, and the issue is the certificate of occupancy. For some larger buildings, in this case 50,000 square feet or larger, that can take up to 18 months to do. In communities that have put information technology in place and actually looked at their process and done some business process reengineering before they put IT in place, they've cut that in that time in half, and that's the bar chart across the top. This has tremendous benefit, not only in terms of day-to-day operations, getting buildings up on the tax rolls faster, people being hired, but you can imagine what the impact is in terms of trying to rebuild after a disaster. It's going to take you 18 months to rebuild as opposed to 9. It is very important. Another piece that we've worked on is the simple concept that we have a number of replicable buildings out there, everything from residential structures to big box stores, Targets, Home Depots. Merit Corporation has 4 different gradations of hotels that they build, but each of those only have 4 different designs. And yet we treat them as if they are a truly unique building every time we do a plan review. So we work together with the International Code Council that produces our model building code codes in the United States to produce a document, which is a guideline that building departments can adopt, that allows them to do single set of plan reviews for that building in a state that has a uniform statewide building code. And indeed, we went in California and were able to reduce the amount of time it took to approve plans for renovations to a Target store from 24 weeks down to 8.5 weeks. You can see the immediate benefit in terms of disaster recovery, but of course that's also day-to-day operations, immediate benefit of getting buildings up in some cases 2 to 3 months faster. State of California, another example, is we did a pilot project with them to show the ability to link diverse mobile field inspection technologies, everything from laptops to PDAs to smartphones, to be interoperable and gather damage assessment information and roll it immediately up to the state EOC, and also to build a statewide and regional network out of that. That has a huge benefit in terms of disaster response and ultimately recovery. But in day-in, day-out operations, in terms of sustainability, jurisdictions using inspection technology are able to reduce the amount of time it takes them to do inspections by 30%. So, again, there's the benefit. We talked about statewide building codes earlier and the fact that 50% of our country still are not covered by codes that adequately – current, modern, and adequately have disaster resiliency provisions within them. Louisiana had nothing when Katrina came in, other than a few parishes in the city of New Orleans had a building code. We worked with the state of Louisiana in the wake of Katrina to put in place a uniform statewide building code, and then we helped them design a roadmap for the application of IT to that system to make it more effective and efficient. And that work is going on inside Louisiana today. Again, a benefit both in terms of disaster resiliency and economic sustainability in terms of Louisiana. We also are doing work in electronic plan review and automated code checking tools that reduce the amount of time it does take to do a plan review by 80%. That has some immediate green benefits to jurisdictions. We talk about sustainability and that you don't have to store paper anymore. You don't have to ship those huge rolls of blueprints around. And we've gone from a very small number of jurisdictions, maybe 10, 5 years ago, with electronic plan review capability, and we're up around 250 now, and it's one of the fastest growing areas in terms of application of IT. A side benefit of that for disaster resiliency is jurisdictions that have all of their plans in electronically can now build a secure database of electronic as-builts that they can provide to their first responders as they roll up on a disaster site. The city of Portland, Maine, is the first one to put such a system in place, and there are about 5 other jurisdictions in different parts of the country that are undertaking that activity. Well, here's some recommendations from out of these efforts. We really do need to bring together the public and private sector, as was kind of the theme of my article. With the emergency management, the economic development, sustainability community to research and establish a list of policy actions and best practices like some of the ones I've covered that promote sustainability and disaster resiliency, and then get those back out across the nation and used both financial, insurance, tax incentives, and legislation to put them in place. And then, indeed, expand the number of jurisdictions that are streamlining their processes, putting IT in place, and using some of the technologies that I've mentioned. Now I'm going to turn to the actual recommendations, four or five of them, from this ENR report from the March 2nd to 3rd conference. And again, there's a link provided to you so you can actually see the report if you have not had the opportunity to see it before. There are 33 overall recommendations to the public and private sector. I'm going to focus on four of these. First of all, to the private sector. Banking, accounting, and insurance industry has a huge impact on building owners what they put into a building, but they have been largely ignoring the financial incentives for retrofitting homes, businesses, for both sustainability and disaster resiliency. Indeed, we have not seen the insurance industry move as quickly as they really should be doing in terms of some tax, insurance rate provisions that support that. Establish a national venue for coordination of changes to the building codes to better coordinate them and reduce the adverse impact on sustainability and disaster resiliency. There's really a lack of predictability right now, and I'll go to the screen that populates it. These are the kinds of issues that the construction industry faces and building owners face in terms of looking at the cost of operating a building, making the decision day in, day out. When I build a building, what provisions am I going to put in? Am I going to meet just the minimum building code? Or am I going to look at some experience in terms of disaster resiliency and put in some features that might make the building more hurricane-proof or more seismically safe? You can't see a couple of the symbols, but the blue circles are financing, occupancy, and operating maintenance costs. Those are key factors in terms of owners and developers' decisions. And then below that are the regulations that impact in terms of what they put in, building and fire safety codes, and energy efficient requirements, environmental sustainability, and resiliency issues. Right now, there's no coordination between the components of the code change, and what that impact is on the building owner, as opposed to stepping back and saying, well, gee, if we increase the energy efficiency here, that's going to drive the costs in this direction. Maybe they'll decide that if they comply with that, they're not going to put certain disaster resiliency features in. And those decisions are being made all the time. And what we're suggesting here is that there really be a concerted effort to try and bring that code change process across multiple regulations into a venue where these discussions can be held up front and we can phase in which provisions we're going to upgrade and when. This is part of the reason why only 50% of our jurisdictions are currently covered by building codes that have disaster resiliency provisions in it. In some cases, the jurisdictions are just sticking with older codes. They've not been able to make the decision to adopt something that's more current and has better provisions. So that certainly is an area that needs to be studied and was a recommendation at the March 2nd and 3rd conference. Recommendations to Congress and administration. The Congress really fund a national infrastructure readiness effort that ensures the codes and standards and permitting systems are able to guide the nation in a more consistent and efficient way over the lifetime of these national assets. Some of you have seen the report card that's issued by the American Society of Civil Engineers every year on our infrastructure, and our infrastructure has consistently got a D rating. Things are just aging and not getting replaced. Two other recommendations: study the possibility of funding some of the mitigation effort through savings that are incurred from reduced cost and disaster relief. This is an area that is going to need some considerable study before it's put in place, but there are some savings there that could be achieved. And then review and identify reduced regulatory barriers to rapid disaster response and recovery. Right now, jurisdictions are pretty good that have had the scale of disasters we've had in terms of deciding which regulations to suspend or put in place to speed recovery, but no one has stepped back and taken a look at what do we do in terms of federal, state, and local regulations in terms of a truly catastrophic event. We're exploring that with in the state of California with CalEMA and also with people in the San Francisco Bay Area. So here are some actions I suggest we take and we can talk about. Working together, first of all, gain some congressional hearings on this actual report and this recommendation. This is the March 2nd, 3rd report. Recommendations both to Congress, to the administration, and to the public and private sector. Secondly, establish a national venue for identifying and recommending actions that link sustainability and resiliency, which I mentioned earlier. Three, work to better inform elected officials and the public and business community about the effectiveness and cost efficiency of putting investments in mitigation and sustainability. And fourthly, let's talk about ways of ending the piecemeal and patchwork, the stovepipe bureaucracy approach towards disaster resiliency. That leads us up to the questions and discussion section. I've put up just a couple of thoughts in terms of things we might want to cover to stimulate some questions. Any comments that you have on this issue of linking sustainability and resiliency, comments or recommendations on some of the proposed actions that I had, and what other actions should be taken that have not been listed. If you've seen the report and you've got some other thoughts about some things that weren't in the report that should be in the report, that would be good to raise too. And then time frame and stakeholders, who must be involved and how do we get them involved. I close here with a quote from one of the participants in the March 2nd, 3rd conference, Stephen Flynn, president of the Center for National Policy, and his comment in the session was, it will be the companies, communities, and countries that are most resilient who will have a competitive advantage over those that are not. And indeed, Eric Haldeman, who was the author of the Black Swan article in Emergency Management Magazine, another quote that I didn't list here that is certainly relevant to this conversation, and that is that most of the time we can't change what happens to us, but we do control how we respond and recover. And with that, I'll turn it back to you, Amy.
Thank you very much, Robert. Most interesting. Okay, we are ready to go to our Q&A. And to submit your input or to ask a question, just click on Q&A from the top menu, and then you'll type in the top half of the box that opens up. Then click on Ask. Now, there is a hand-raising feature there, but we do not use that. When you do click on Ask, your comment or question goes to an administration panel that I will moderate. I will announce who the question is from or comment and read it aloud, and our guests will respond via the conference bridge. And then I will also type in a little text pay, which will release the text of the question to your panel. Now, the way this works, there's only, the mechanics of it, you can only submit one question or comment at a time. Please do keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. And I am going to go back to these questions that Robert has posed for us on the theme. And we're certainly, he's interested, and we're interested in hearing your thoughts on any of these. Okay, let's see. Okay, I have a question from Derek White, who says, there is a lot of anti-government sentiment out there in some states leading to resistance to building standards. Yet the federal government helps with recovery equally in every state. Should the Stafford Act be changed to favor those states with stronger building codes? That's an interesting idea.
That's a great question. In fact, it was discussed and was one of the side discussions you'll find in the report at the McGraw-Hill Engineering News Record Conference in March, that is indeed worthwhile considering doing something like that, but put a time frame in that said states have 2 years or 3 years in which to bring their codes up to those levels. And then, indeed, Stafford Act from there on will go that way. Department of Energy is doing something somewhat similar in terms of mandating that all the states in the country have in place by 2017 energy conservation codes for residential commercial structures that meet certain minimum national standards. And so there's a major push there. And obviously you put some carrots and sticks in there as well. So it indeed is something worthwhile. States have gone from they're currently about 25 states that have some form of statewide building code, although some of those are pretty weak. They're purely voluntary. If you adopt a code, you got to use this code. But we do have a good core of about 15 states that have very strong building codes and indeed have active and aggressive enforcement programs on disaster mitigation provisions as well as sustainability in some cases. So we've seen some progress there, but it certainly is worthwhile being considered to be one of those issues that we'd like to see congressional discussion on.
Good deal. While we wait for a couple more questions, I've got one, Robert. Are you already observing cutbacks in local government in terms of code enforcement or building departments, you know, because of the fiscal crunch that most of the states and local cities are in?
Absolutely. In some cases, it's been decimated to the point that some jurisdictions have privatized to varying degrees of success. This whole code enforcement aspect, in some cases, they've done it in such a way that I think they will have an efficient system. In some cases, I think they will have a nightmare. We have seen some jurisdictions that have had limited funds work with the private sector to get a surcharge put on building permits that enable them to put information technology in place so that they can be more efficient with what staff they have remaining. City of Bend, Oregon has taken IT and put it in place for all aspects of their program, and they're able to operate and provide inspection services and plan review services for neighboring smaller jurisdictions in Deschutes County that have been decimated and had to cut their staff. So IT is really coming to the rescue and in some cases on this issue, but it is one of concern that we're going to need many of those people back to help us when we have a major disaster and we're just not going to have the bodies. In this case, that's why linking together mobile field inspection technology was a priority that we've been working with California on, because they know they don't have as many inspectors that they can draw from people from other states in terms of a really cataclysmic event, and just have them bring their mobile devices and we can link it all. That's a big help. So, indeed, the economy is having that impact.
I have a question from Emily Myers, who asks, what efforts, if any, are being taken to increase the insurance incentives to mitigate and build in more sustainable ways? I know that IBHS has instituted some above-code standards, but I haven't heard of others.
Yeah, and it's mostly been IBHS. We do have a couple of individual insurance companies, for example, that are trying to look at their rate structure. They have not made such major changes yet, but there's a lot of feedback out of the Japan experience that I mentioned earlier, having, you know, the insurance companies themselves are very concerned about a Japan-sized event and what that will do to their industry. IBHS, I think, is going to get more traction because of that. And, indeed, it's one of the things that we wanted to spend some time in terms of a congressional hearing to bring to the table the insurance industry, because we've got some companies that are really trying to do something positive and others that are just kind of hanging back, and it really needs to be dealt with in a positive fashion.
Let me follow up on that with another question. You know, you mentioned trying to get a congressional hearing. I was not clear. Have the recommendations that grew out of the March conference, have they at least gone to staff or anything
Okay. Yes, the recommendations were delivered to the chiefs of staff of the both majority and minority of each of the committees in the House and Senate that have oversight on the disaster mitigation or homeland security, and those were delivered sometime in August. It is in their hands.
Yeah, we might follow up with you, but I think there's still in existence a Natural Hazards Caucus in the Congress, and that might be something they...
Exactly, and that has been the hope, that not that Congress hasn't been distracted, but this Mother Nature and terrorists don't wait for people to, the 2012 election to be over.
Right. Okay, let's move on to a couple more questions. I've got one from Ava Jean who says, Robert, thanks for your presentation. You mentioned stakeholders. Are there any communities you know of where citizens or stakeholders are taking an active role or demanding better codes, et cetera, for sustainability? If so, how? If not, how can we move in that direction?
Yes, there are, and that's one of the things that is a recommendation is we really try and gather a good list and then make those jurisdictions available in terms of best practice. I mentioned Bend, Oregon. Bend has done a lot across the state to try and encourage more effective enforcement. The state of Oregon has a uniform building code. It does have disaster mitigation provisions in it. It does have some sustainability provisions in it in terms of some of the energy side. But you can have the best language in a code, and if you don't have effective enforcement, all you've got is a piece of paper. So it goes hand in hand with it. We have seen efforts in Louisiana, obviously in the wake of Katrina, to make some significant improvements, not just in the base state code, but also in the issue of sustainability. There's a very active group in the city of New Orleans trying to marry together some of the disaster mitigation provisions and sustainability provisions. I know that in terms of the code change process, there are some proposed code changes before the International Code Council for their family of codes that include some sustainability and some disaster resiliency issues.
I wanted to ask you about who the sustainability stakeholders are. Are they mostly professional planners, like American Planning Association? I mean, where are we finding these sustainability advocates?
They're all over the place, and in some cases they're very small networks. In some cases it's groups like the Green Building Council. Just in the Bay Area, I was on a conference call earlier this week working on a project in terms of disaster resiliency within the Bay Area, and on that call were several small local community groups that are very concerned about the sustainability issue. And in California, there's a minimal code that you use, but each of the jurisdictions, city and county of San Francisco, for example, can adopt more stringent provisions, both in terms of something like sustainability and disaster resiliency, and that's the kind of target that they're focusing on.
So it varies from community to community, basically, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Okay, I have this one's a little bit long. Bear with me on this. I will release it so you can look it over, from Pat S., who asked, should the Stafford Act be amended to require mitigation of publicly funded, parentheses, the Public Assistance Program, state and local assets damaged or destroyed by natural disaster? In other words, a bridge destroyed by flooding will be replaced exactly as it was before the disaster at taxpayer expense. It is not required to mitigate bigger, better, or stronger to prevent the same thing from happening again. It is optional, and the jurisdiction must pay a portion of the mitigation cost.
And it would be wonderful to see that there would be some additional federal funds. This gets back to the carrot and stick question, too, earlier about statewide codes. To see that the act was amended that jurisdictions we're able to build back above the original standard it was built to. And that is indeed one of the problems that many communities face. They're very disaster prone if, you know, they have a structure that was built in 1962 and very little was done to retrofit it to new standards. You know, the costs are astronomical to build it to, you know, 2011 requirements. So that is one of the things that, again, looking at the need for some congressional hearings would be wonderful to get some input on how, you know, how can we make that happen and not bankrupt everybody.
Robert, could you address the need, you know, when we talk about building codes, we think of new construction, and this kind of segues from your last comment, the need for retrofitting. I mean, the existing building stock is, you know, much of it not built under any codes.
It depends on where you are. I mean, unfortunately, some parts of the country have been building codes around since 1916. But very few places like that. Huge problem in terms of retrofit. When the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed in the early 1990s, and was put in place, there were some mandates in there in terms of jurisdictions putting in place provisions that indeed made buildings accessible under retrofit circumstances, certainly all new construction. But now if you are redoing a certain percentage of a building, you have to make the whole building accessible. That kind of thought process really ought to be looked at in terms of renovation provisions, and indeed some states have some triggers like that and have had some separate programs. California and Oregon have had programs on when you go to renovate, in some cases change occupancy on unreinforced masonry construction, you have to put certain mitigation provisions in to make sure that it is able to withstand a minimal level of earthquake as opposed to the bricks are in the street. So, indeed, that does indeed need to happen. Between now and 2050, 99% of our building stock is already built. So, yes, it's a huge problem.
Well, another question from Emily Myers, who's building on the public assistance program question. With a focus on streamlining, it seems that the additional mitigation funding available for rebuilding public infrastructure is underutilized because of difficulties in process. Is this something under review for streamlining?
Yes. Simple answer, yes. And we're trying to push it at the national level for jurisdictions to pay attention to, and there are some jurisdictions that are. But clearly it's an important issue.
Do you see any natural venue for going forward and convening stakeholders from, you know, across the spectrum that you described, or are there any ideas on that floating out there?
Well, there's kind of an alphabet soup of associations and organizations involved in the construction industry and in the insurance industry, and it's really, you know, one of the thoughts, you know, the National Building Museum could, together with some of the people who sponsored and participated in the March 2nd and 3rd conference, really could bring some people together to follow up on the recommendations within that, especially if there are either going to be hearings or there's a follow-up to hearings that are held on Capitol Hill. So, you know, there really is a fairly substantial group of associations that there's no single one that bridges everybody in terms of sustainability or the insurance industry or the banking industry or the construction industry. But, the, you know, there are some possibilities.
You know, I didn't even know we had a National Building Museum until we started planning this program today. And I noticed that they are planning a, looks like a major exhibit for
yes.
about a year from now. And it would seem that that might be a good thing to be aiming for at that event.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, got another one from Ava Jean. And she says, the quote by Stephen Flynn is certainly notable regarding companies, communities, and countries having an competitive advantage. Since the private sector owns so much of our resources as it relates to disasters, how are organizations like the Chamber of Commerce involved and elected officials?
That is a good question. Jurisdictions, and I mentioned this group working on disaster resiliency in the San Francisco Bay Area. The Association of Bay Area Governments is kind of the convener. Some jurisdictions, there's a very strong outreach to the private sector. Going back to a group called the Infrastructure Security Partnership, or TISP, some of you may be familiar with, that was really created as an effort to bring the public and private sector together to focus on disaster preparedness, albeit originally out of a terrorist event in the wake of 9/11. But it is vital for communities, and that's one of the things as we've talked about regulatory streamlining, we have been talking to communities that they have to bring their key stakeholders in from the private sector, because they're the ones with the points of pain. In fact, in some cases, they're the only ones who can describe what their regulatory system looks like. It's so broken up by stovepipes that it's absolutely essential that the private sector be involved in that and help create programs of resiliency for a community, and I would argue for sustainability as well. So there are some places where that's actually happening and it's quite well organized, and there are other places where it's the public and private sector still see each other as not working together on the same page, which is a real shame.
Yeah, you mentioned this earlier, but the idea of compiling these shining examples, I think would be very educational for people, because mostly we hear about people fighting these efforts, or at least that's what the news media seems to focus on. So
right, and if I go back to that bubble chart that I showed earlier in terms of the kinds of issues that building owners and operators face. Part of it is that it's such a moving, because all these pieces come at them piecemeal. Somebody changes an energy code, but there's no correlation between what they're changing in the fire code. I mean, they can face some major cost factors that preclude the owner from deciding, well, I'm going to renovate. I'm just going to leave my building as is because everything's changing so fast, I don't want to be in violation of it, so I'm just going to leave it as is. And that doesn't create resiliency. That creates the opposite problem.
I see a question from our good friend Tom Fahey, and he says, Congress has been loath to get into the debate to establish national mandatory building codes since they view this issue as a state legislature issue. You make extremely valid points about resiliency. However, besides the occurrence of a massive black swan event, how can we get the changes needed to establish standards based and effective building codes, not only for new construction, but retrofits for structures considered to be questionable?
Well, and that gets to the earlier comment. Department of Energy is doing this, folks. They are working with the states to get them to all have in place upgraded energy codes across the country. And I actually worked ran an association representing state building officials and governor's association, so loath to see a federal building code. There are things you can do to put incentives in place that get states to put in a statewide building code and get states to put in adequate and effective and efficient enforcement mechanisms. And we've talked about some of those. I mean, this concept of making some changes in the Stafford Act. All of this, we bring the parties to the table. It is indeed something that can be done.
Once again, we have Emily Myers. Bless you, Emily. She says, in Florida, we encourage post-disaster redevelopment plans, parentheses, pre-planning for the rebuild, which take a holistic perspective.
Right.
And use economic, health and human services, environmental, and historic. As growth management has been taking a hit, we see communities having difficulties getting the motivation to conduct this kind of planning. Are there other incentives we can turn to, like the community rating system, to encourage our communities?
Yes, there are, and again, you know, that gets back at my discussion about getting the insurance industry to the table and the banking community, that you really should, you know, these should be the advocates for these provisions going in place, this kind of process going in place, because all you're doing is throwing good money after bad if you're just constantly rebuilding in the same vulnerable spot for flooding or, you know, storm surge or whatever, and not putting in place mitigation provisions. So, you know, the answer to that is yes, but it really needs all these stakeholders coming together.
And it sounds like, you know, they're providing some leadership but finding some challenges. So
yep.
That's the reality most everywhere. No more questions on the list. Oh, wait a minute. Here comes one from Isabel, bless her heart. Isabel McCurdy, she says, Robert, would you elaborate on what the Black Swan event is about?
Oh, sure. I'll sell a book. Not my book. It really is, Nassim Nicholas Taleb wrote a book a few years ago that really describes the impact of something that's wholly improbable. And because it's improbable, we don't ever think about having to prepare for it. And so something like a Katrina-sized event or something like the you know, Japan thought that their seismic safety codes were going to be fine to protect them from the problems that they had, and that they thought they had adequately prepared for a tsunami, but they found out that neither their nuclear facility safeguards, you know, having the generators located in a place where a huge storm surge really could knock them out. We faced that with Katrina. Most hospitals had their emergency backup generators on the ground floor. And, you know, why in the world would you put them on the ground floor in an area where you're below sea level, as much of New Orleans is? So a Black Swan event is just, and it comes from the concept of almost all of us just see white swans, and we just assume there are no black swans, but they do exist. And so most of us will continue to prepare for the kind of event that, you know, we've seen at the kind of scale, and we've seen them in the past, not realizing that something out of left field literally can become a reality, and you could get a combination of, in California, a black swan event would be, in the Sacramento area, they have as many levees and have as much under below sea level, if you will, as the New Orleans area does. And their concern is, what if they have major flooding? In fact, they did a statewide drill on this this past May that I participated in, and at the same time, massive flooding. At the same time, you have a major quake event in the San Francisco Bay Area where a lot of this water ends up heading. How do you prepare for something as catastrophic as that? And so that's what refers to as the black, is the improbable event that the laws of we think tell us will never happen actually will happen, and you have to prepare for them. And that's the concept. But it's not an easy read, but you can very quickly get a synopsis of it if you go to the book or go to the May June issue of Emergency Management Magazine. Mr. Haldeman has a very good summary in his article, in his column, about black swan events that defines it nicely.
And I think I do have a link to that article on our background page also, so you might check there. And if it's not there, I will put it there.
That's great.
Okay, Emily, once again, what kind of progress has been made with the banking community for incentives? Is this
minimal? Minimal.
Well, it goes on to ask, is this an individual bank-by-bank effort, or is a broader national consortium looking at this?
No broader national consortium is looking at it, and that's the problem. And especially since we've seen banks go through this major consolidation where 15, 20 years ago, there were all kinds of mom-and-pop branches of banks, and now we're down to maybe 20 major national banks and just a smattering of small local banks. This really needs to be looked at. We've tried to get the American Bankers Association interested in it years ago, and they haven't come to the table, and we would love to see them there.
Of course, the most recent meltdown didn't help any, right?
Right.
All right, another one from Ava G. With the economy making money and funding harder for everyone to get, from your experience, do you see the lack of funding as a reason to not do what is needed with codes, et cetera, or can we turn this into an impetus to do a better job with what we have to work with?
I think it's the latter. I think we can, and one of the things that would help, though, would be some kind of coordination, review of what changes are going into which codes at which time and how those have a bottom-line impact on the decisions being made by our building owners. It's kind of one of those, it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. It's precisely, and here's an example, precisely at the time when state and local governments had the least amount of money and the least staff, we're seeing tremendous growth in their application of IT to their building departments, specifically because the elected officials are finally realizing if they could get a building up and operational faster, it's on the tax rolls faster, it means jobs in the community faster, and the private sector is saying, we're willing to pay the surcharge, we just don't want you to take the surcharge and go do something else with it on top of the permit. So there's an example of something that is going on that really has some application to this other issue. So, yes, it can be done.
Great. And I've got one final question for you. I think we're about to see, if it hasn't come out already, an updated national preparedness goal. What do you think?
Right.
Do you think we might need a similar kind of document? Because it does not really address, at least the draft does not really address these issues so much. Do you think it would be helpful to have a national resiliency goal?
In fact, the administration has mandated that every federal agency include resiliency as a priority area. So it really needs to be integrated in there in the fullest definition of resiliency. It is a combination of what you do prior to prepare your communities as well as how fast can you come back after the disaster. It gets at the heart of a lot of the questions that were asked, including the one about making changes in the Stafford Act in terms of allowing jurisdictions to be able to build back to the more stringent codes.
Very good. Well, I think we'll go ahead and start wrapping it up for today. Thank you very much, Robert. So we definitely appreciate you taking the time to be with us and to share this information. And we would like to stay in touch and follow your efforts in the future and wish you best.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Here's the contact information. Again, we'll have that in the transcript or in the slide deck. The video and audio recording should be available later this afternoon. Now I'm going to put up our little post-session review, and before you run off, would you please take a moment to add your comments there. And again, this is just how relevant was this information for you. Now, we are very pleased to announce two new EIIP partners today, the Emergency Management Academy, a global organization providing intensive graduate-level education in emergency management theory, continuing education and consultant, and their representative is Scott Phelps, professor and facilitator. And then appropriately enough, we are also pleased to welcome the Natural Hazard Mitigation Association, established for the purpose of bringing together individuals and organizations working in the field of hazard mitigation. Their representative is Alessandra Gerelman, Executive Director. If your organization is interested in becoming an EIP partner, please see the link on our homepage, or it's included with each email announcement. Our next program will take place Wednesday, October 12th, and please watch for our announcement and plan to be with us then. I want to say a special thank you for the folks that did have some excellent questions for us today. We appreciate that very much. Until next time, thanks to everyone for participating, and have a great afternoon. We are adjourned.